So, welcome to the Outdoor Citizen Podcast. This is episode 78. Your host today, Marty Jones, produced and edited by Owen Woods. And our guest today is Dr. Chris Ray. And we'll be chatting with her in just a minute. Before we get started, I want to be sure to thank Don Richmond for the music that you hear during the podcast, and Daniel Boyce for the sounds of the valley's birds, including sounds of the cranes, which are coming back to the valley. So, as I mentioned earlier, our guest today is Dr. Chris Ray, Research Associate at the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Dr. Ray, thanks for joining us, and if you don't mind, I'll call you Chris during this interview.
That sounds great, Marty.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a researcher at heart, and I call myself a perpetual postdoc. I've been at the University of Colorado for some 20-odd years, and I've been studying the American pika for about 40 years, and I just don't want to give it up. I love going into the mountains and learning more about the animals and plants there, and I'm especially interested in how they're responding to climate.
Well, great. So I understand that you were a lead author in a study published in the journal Arctic, Antarctic, and Alpine Research about the declining number of American pika. Can you tell us how you conducted this study, where it was conducted, and give us the highlights from that study?
Yeah, the study was conducted at a place called Niwot Ridge, which is a big feature in the Southern Rockies, where there have been studies of pikas in the past. One was conducted in the 1980s, and then I started studying them there in about 2004. And my goal in this study was to look at whether or not the population is behaving kind of the same way now as it was back in the 1980s. And to do that, I compared the ratio of juvenile pikas, young pikas, to adult pikas that were trapped in the 80s. And the same ratio that were trapped in the 2000s, from 2004 to 2020. And I found that there was a big difference. So back in the 1980s, they were trapping pikas. I mean, this was a live trapping study. They're not trapping them and killing them or anything. Just trapping them and tagging them and taking a look at how many juveniles and adults are in the population. And they found about 1.5 juveniles for every adult that they trapped. And during my study, I'm finding less than half a juvenile for every adult that I trap. So this is an incredibly strong decline in either the production of juveniles in the population or the number of juveniles coming into the population from nearby populations.
That's an amazing decrease. Before we go farther, can you give our listeners an idea of what an average lifespan for a pika is?
Yeah, it's a little slippery because the average doesn't necessarily mean much. A juvenile pika has a lot lower chance of survival during its first year than an adult does once it's established a territory. So the whole reason I did this study was that we conducted a study in Rocky Mountain National Park over 10 years ago, where it looked like, based on genetics, juvenile pikas were having trouble moving across south-facing slopes and lower elevations. Those are, of course, warmer places in the landscape. And so we ended up predicting that there would be maybe no pikas left in Rocky Mountain National Park by the end of this century, due to, you know, losses that couldn't be turned around by juveniles going and recolonizing these places where pikas are lost. So so I turned to this data set on Niwot Ridge, which is just south of the park, to look for evidence that juveniles are being produced locally and arriving locally just as well as they always did. And unfortunately, I found that they aren't. They aren't there as often as they were in the past.
So is there an explanation? Is this due to increased predation, or what other explanations are possible for the decline in the juvenile population?
Well, our original hypothesis was that juveniles might have more and more trouble moving across these landscapes as the climate warms. So a pika is born in the spring, and by the time it's 2 months old, it's looking for a territory of its own. And it only has a few months to do that, to find a territory and start collecting food for the winter. Pikas make a what we call a hay pile, and they feed on that all winter long. So they're pressed for time, and you know, some of them can settle in open territories right near where they were born, but others, maybe there's not room for them, and they need to move across the landscape and find another place where they can establish a territory. And as the summers warm, pikas are exposed to higher heat as they're traveling across the landscape. Pikas are incredibly thermally sensitive. They have to survive long winters at high elevation, so they have a really high metabolic rate and a really high resting body temperature so that they can stay warm all winter. But during the summer, that makes them susceptible to overheating. And during the summer is when they have to disperse. They have to move from their natal territory and find their own territory. And so they're kind of in this between a rock and a hard place. And they're also looking for rocks. So they can only live on these jumbles of broken rock that we call talus. And talus isn't a common thing in the landscape. A talus is like a rock slide or something, and you can think about how many times you've seen those. I mean, we see them sometimes when we're driving along, and they're one by the side of the road, but they're not continuously distributed in the landscape. So they have to go find these patches of rock. And the reason they need these patches of rock is that these taluses are just amazing in their ability to maintain cool temperatures underneath the surface. If you find a talus slope and you stick your hand down between the rocks, it's going to be so much cooler underneath there than it is up on the surface during the summertime. And the pikas use that cool space to just cool off because they're running so hot all the time. In fact, pikas are, the temperature of a pika is only about 3 degrees lower than its lethal temperature.
Oh, that's... So that, that's not good.
Yeah.
and my understanding is that pikas do not hibernate in the winter, so it's pretty important for them to have a sufficient haystack that they can continue to eat all winter.
That's right. Because they don't hibernate, they need to maintain a high body temperature all winter, which means they need calories to do that. You got to ingest calories to make heat in their bodies. And in order to have enough calories, they have to have a big enough hay pile. It has to be a high enough quality hay pile. So all summer, which is a brief period of time, the pika has to collect vegetation and store it in its hay pile. And this is a really energetic activity. It's been equated to maybe you going to the grocery store and putting 3 cabbages in your mouth and running home, you know, over 1,000 times. So pikas really have to get out there in the heat and move around. And so in between these bouts of foraging and in between bouts of defending their territory and finding mates, they need to get down in these cool spaces and cool off.
I was talking with a friend last week, as a matter of fact, who was lamenting the lack of snow cover in the high country here down in southern Colorado, in the San Juans and the Sangre de Cristos, and how that might also impact the pika's ability to survive the winter without that snow to provide an insulating layer over the Tala slopes.
That's absolutely right. So they need a hay pile that's sufficient for the cold that they're exposed to over the winter. And as that snowpack thins, they're exposed to more and more cold over the winter. When there's a thick snowpack, it keeps the ground underneath it at near 0 degrees or freezing. And pikas are really built for that temperature. That's the temperature where they seem to be most comfortable during the summer, right about freezing. But as we all know, above the snow, it can get well below freezing in the free air. And we don't want pikas to be exposed to that, but they're getting exposed to it more and more. And that often probably means that their hay pile isn't sufficient to help them survive that.
Another potential consequence of climate change, at least in our immediate area, the lack of snow. So where else have you done some observations of pika?
Well, my longest term study is up in Montana, where I've been studying them since 1989, and I've gone there every summer since.
Wow.
And there I see now, unfortunately, some evidence of decline as well, although I don't have that evidence organized and analyzed well enough to publish just yet. Another place is right in your backyard. I worked in Great Sand Dunes.
Oh, nice.
National Park and Preserve. In the upper elevations of that park and preserve, there are a lot of pikas, and they're actually doing quite well up there. And that's just a really wonderful outcome of this work that we did, you know, over 10 years ago and now. Although the prediction that we had over 10 years ago was also that there should be some decline in the population in Great Sand Dunes. It wasn't anywhere near as dramatic as in Rocky Mountain National Park. And it was predicted that it would maybe turn around in, later in the century as the climate continued to change, because projections for Great Sand Dunes National Park aren't quite as dire as for Rocky Mountain National Park. And we're seeing that there hasn't been any decline yet in Great Sand Dunes.
That's good. So if people want to observe some pikas in the wild, maybe that's a good location to go.
Yeah, absolutely. The highest elevations in the park are the place to visit.
And not on the dunes themselves, but in the Sangre de Cristos.
No, yeah, go up to Music Pass and hike from there.
Great. So is there anything that humans can do to try to increase the pika population?
Well, yeah, we struggle with that. We have the problem that we could say, well, let's reverse climate change. That's kind of a big ask.
Right.
So one thing that we can do is to make sure that we manage other risks that pikas might be facing, such as introduced diseases. One of which that's been in the news a lot lately is rabbit hemorrhagic disease, which has been quite common in York County and others surrounding Great Sand Dunes National Park. We just studied that, and we looked at the potential for rabbits and hares to overlap with pikas and maybe transmit it to pikas, because pikas are very closely related to rabbits and hares. And so we expect that they can get rabbit hemorrhagic disease. However, we don't know for sure yet. So we did find, unfortunately, that there's some overlap in the park and possibility that this disease will be wicked up into the higher elevations. But another disease is plague. So literally the Black Death, it came into the port at San Francisco in about 1900, and it swept eastward and ended up about where we are now. It hasn't gone all the way to the East Coast, but it had huge effects on all kinds of animals throughout the West. And in Asia, it is centered really in the mountain marmot populations. And of course, the pikas are living very closely with the mountain marmot populations here. So understanding the dynamics of plague and whether or not that's a new threat to pikas will be important. Those are things we can do to try to make sure we're managing the landscape best for them.
Great. So you've spent a lot of time up in the tundra studying these pika. What do you find most appealing about them, and what makes them unique?
Wow. Well, I said they're related to rabbits and hares, but boy, are they different. So they're extremely vocal, and they're extremely territorial. And so that leads to a lot of amusing antics, pikas yelling and chasing each other. And then, of course, there's this wonderful practice they have of making the hay pile, which entails running out from the rocks and collecting a whole bunch of flowers in their mouths and running back with them. And so they're very photogenic and fun to watch as they leap over the rocks with, you know, often plants that are longer than them, you know, flowers bouncing along, and it's just too much fun to watch. So the other thing about them is that they're individually recognizable. I mean, I can tell the difference between their calls, and I can tell the difference between their personalities and kind of predict who's going to be a bully and who's going to be adventurous. And, you know, it's just really, really wonderful to have an animal that is so visible because it's living in this really open habitat and so territorial that you can go back to the same spot and see the same animal over and over again if you want to. So to me, they're just a joy to watch. And they're also what we call diurnal. Most of their activity is during the day. So lucky for us, we're able to observe them. Some researchers think that they might become more nocturnal with climate change, and that's how they'll manage to get along. It's not clear that they have the adaptations needed, like, you know, nighttime eyes and stuff to really make it during the night. But what a loss for us. If they become more nocturnal, we won't see them anymore, which is sad.
Yeah, right. What could we learn from them if we spent more time up in the alpine, up in the tundra with the pika?
Well, unfortunately, we might, if things keep going the way they are, we might learn that our water resources are declining. So pikas in those taluses I was talking about, the taluses are, you know, really remarkable for keeping the ground cool underneath them. Basically, it's like a chimney. Any warm air in the area escapes through cracks and goes up and out of the talus, and any cool air in the area pools in the talus. And so you get this super cooled ground that can hold permafrosts or seasonal ice. Well, these sources of ice are really important for humans because they provide late summer meltwaters to resupply our reservoirs. And so these places are the last best spots for this water resource. And if the pikas are disappearing because the microclimates are changing and too warm for them, then that means that our water resource might be changing and disappearing. And so We think of them as a bit of an indicator species, and that's one of the most important things we can learn from them.
Well, that's very interesting. And I need to tell our listeners that although this is not a visual podcast, you can't see the picture of the pika that I'm looking at right now with the with the grass in its mouth. It's just as cute as a bug. Or cute as a button, or whatever the appropriate response is. But I've seen pika in the past, but you know, it's, I guess I don't get up into the high country enough to be able to say that I see them on a regular basis. I can hear them, but it's pretty tough for me to spot them sometimes. Is there any, are there any tricks that you can suggest for when we're up hiking in the high country to be able to see the pika?
Yeah, so if you can find yourself a big jumble of rocks, a talus slope, a boulder field, you just sit and hang out for a while. You'll probably hear marmots chirping. They have a very high-pitched whistle that's audible from far away. And then you might hear pikas yelling, and they have what we call an alarm call that sounds more like eek, and it's not, you know, huge like the marmot whistle. And so you can start looking for them. They're only about as big as your fist. They look a lot like a baked potato with Mickey Mouse ears, but they're a lot cuter, like you said. I think they look like a tiny little bear cub, basically. They don't have a tail. They don't have the big long legs of a rabbit or the big long ears. Their ears are basically the one of the only ears in the animal kingdom that do look like Mickey Mouse ears, except that they're, you know, tan instead of black, and super adorable. But yeah, only as big as your fist. And they will likely come right up to you and potentially try to get some salt off of you by licking your shoelaces or your backpack straps or something like that. One at a time, of course, because they're territorial, and so you're not going to have several of them on you. But it can happen if you're sitting in one place for a while.
Has that happened to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've had them try to hay my shoelaces. We call it haying when they grab a stalk of a flower and run off with it. And yeah, they'll be tugging on that. And yep, they come up and lick my water bottle because there's salt on the outside. And it's real interesting. It's actually kind of challenging trying to get their behavior recorded when they're focused on you instead of what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, it's a little difficult.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, do you have any final thoughts, any suggestions for our listeners?
Well, one of the things we've done in order to understand what's going on with pikas is we've started some community science programs. And one of them is run by the Mountain Studies Institute in your area. And people can get involved and get trained and actually go out and participate in our surveys for pikas throughout the mountains of Colorado. So that's a fun thing people can do.
Great. And is there a website that people should visit in order to sign up to be citizen scientists?
Yeah, absolutely. In the Denver area, it's called pikapartners.org. And in your area, I would look at the website for Mountain Studies Institute.
Well, we've been speaking with Dr. Chris Ray, Research Associate at the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado Boulder, who's been telling us about American pika. Dr. Ray, thank you so much for being here and joining us on the Outdoor Citizen podcast.
Thank you so much, Marty.
And we'll take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. You're listening to the Outdoor Citizen podcast. We'll be right back.
Looking for the freshest food in the valley? Introducing the new SLB Local Foods Directory, where you can meet your neighbors and eat better. From colorful potatoes and crisp greens to farm-fresh eggs, dairy, and meat, find exactly who grows your food right here in the valley. Support local, eat fresh, and strengthen our community. Are you a local farmer or producer? Add your information. Visit elmasacitizen.com today and discover the freshest food from the heart of the valley.
Welcome back to the Outdoor Citizen podcast. A little bit about our outdoor conditions. Today, for example, the wind is averaging 25 to 30 miles an hour. It's not all that cold, but the wind chill is definitely noticeable. February has so far averaged a daily high of 54.1 degrees. That's more than 10 degrees warmer than usual. Snowpack remains historically low across the upper Rio Grande and Colorado River basins. Forecast is calling for snow and frigid temperatures all week. Much of the West and Great Basin will receive some well-needed snow. Some parts of Colorado's high country could see a few feet of snow, including Wolf Creek Pass, which could see up to 2 feet, according to the National Weather Service. Much-needed snow. There's a hope that a changing weather pattern from La Nina to El Nino at some point this year will deliver the goods and avoid even more of a collapse in the valley's unconfined aquifer and reservoir storage. Local water experts presenting at the Southern Rocky Mountain Ag Conference last week said they're expecting a poor spring runoff and that without real snowpack, reservoir storage will continue to be unwell and an unconfined aquifer will continue getting worse and worse. It's not too late to do your snow and rain dances. In fact, every day, please participate. March and April typically bring a good bit of moisture to the San Luis Valley and our surrounding mountains. So let's hope that this March and April are more typical months. Now for some news. Colorado sent 33 athletes to Italy to compete in the Winter Olympics, more than any other state. Colorado's athletes make up 15% of the total number of U.S. athletes competing this year. And the Winter Olympics are still going on. If you get a chance, tune in every once in a while and see some of our athletes. Interim Director for Colorado Parks and Wildlife, Laura Clellan, has been named the sole finalist for the position. Clellan took over after former director Jeff Davis resigned in November and was among 150 candidates interviewed for the job. Clellan rose to the top because she has decades of leadership, CPW Commissioner Dallas May said. She previously served as Adjutant General and Executive Director of the Colorado Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. She also has a degree in biology, and she achieved the rank of Major General in the Colorado Army National Guard after overseeing 3,700 citizen soldiers and serving in Afghanistan. The Colorado Department of Natural Resources said the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission will hold a special virtual public meeting February 23rd to consider Clellan's appointment. The Colorado State Forest Service is out with a reminder this week that trees need watering. The warm winter and absence of snow means you should probably pull out the garden hose to give your trees a drink. Just remember to disconnect the hose when you're done. Making sure your trees receive adequate water throughout the winter and before irrigation is turned on for the year is necessary in Colorado so the trees survive into the growing season, says Kerry Tomlinson, urban and community forest manager for the Colorado State Forest Service. The moisture ideally comes from snow, but when it's dry, we need to water the trees ourselves. Alamosa reached 62 degrees on February 9th to set a new high for the date. Overall, February is averaging 54 degrees for a high this year. Tomlin says planted trees in Colorado, especially at lower elevations, often require additional watering in the winter during extended dry periods. Overly dry trees become susceptible to a host of health concerns, such as root and branch dieback, and then insect and disease problems. Here are a few winter watering tips. Water when it's warm. The best time for winter watering is on days when snow has melted and the temperature is above 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Water a wide area. Tree root systems may spread much wider than the height of the tree, with most absorbing roots in the top foot of soil. Apply water to soak the entire area underneath the full span of a tree's branches. Water slowly. To ensure deep penetration, use a drip or soaker hose on a low setting or soft spray wand to apply water slowly to the full area at a rate of about 10 gallons per inch of tree diameter. Mulch the tree. To retain soil moisture and save water, apply 4 inches of organic mulch onto bare soil within 2 to 3 feet from the base of the trunk, but not directly against the trunk. Repeat these watering steps as necessary. Until abundant spring precipitation arrives, be sure to continue watering every few weeks in the absence of snow. And now a look at some upcoming outdoor events. Colorado Trout Unlimited's Tie for the Future Challenge turns fly tying into real support for youth conservation and education programs across the state, including Trout in the Classroom, youth fly fishing, and hands-on watershed learning. It's also a friendly statewide contest between TU chapters to see who can tie the most flies, with bragging rights going to the top tying chapter at the Colorado Spring Rendezvous. This winter, the local chapter, the San Luis Valley chapter of Trout Unlimited, is hosting two local tie-ins where you can sit down, tie flies you'd actually fish, and help stock the fly boxes that get used in these programs. The two upcoming event dates are Saturday, February 28th at the Colorado Farm Brewery from 1 to 4 p.m., that's at 2020 County Road 12 South, Alamosa, Colorado. And the second one is Saturday, March 14th, Spare Keg Brew Works in Alamosa, also from 1 to 4 p.m. And the Spare Keg is located at 625 Main Street in Alamosa. Bring your vise, tools, and whatever materials you like. Patterns can be simple. Woolly buggers, pheasant tails, caddas, midges, foam dries, terrestrials, anything you feel like fishing with yourself. If you can't make the tie-ins, you can still participate by tying at home and either mailing flies directly to Colorado Trout Unlimited or get them to Kevin Milder. He'll include them with our chapter submission so that SLVTU can get credit in the challenge. Let's see how many flies the San Luis Valley chapter can put on the board. If you have questions, please contact Kevin Milder at slvtroutunlimited@gmail.com. The second Sippin' Science event is February 27th at the Trade and Post in Del Norte. This session will discuss the water beneath our feet and dive deeper into groundwater. In partnership with the Rio Grande Headwaters Land Trust, it's part of a series of events that shines light on our natural resource systems and beer. Sippin' Science in the SLV is a year-long series designed to help the community learn about the natural systems that define our region. Each of our sessions focuses on a different environmental topic that directly affects life here in the San Luis Valley. The event is free to attend. And you can listen to our January conversation with Jocelyn Catterson about the initial Sippin' Science event. And you can find that on alamosacitizen.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up in a month, the 43rd Annual Monte Vista Crane Festival, March 6th through 8th. Celebrate as tens of thousands of sandhill cranes migrate through the San Luis Valley and fill the skies and the pastures with their prehistoric song and dance. Crafts, local art, speakers, and tours. It's a weekend filled with community engagement and lots of birds. And as you heard earlier, Jesse Casillas will be leading a couple of tours. You can sign up for those tours at mvcranefest.org. The keynote on Saturday is by author and cartoonist Rosemary Moscow for a humorous exploration of birds that blends art, science, and history. Learn why cartoons can help conserve our beloved avifauna. Discover the shocking secrets of common species and what they can teach us about ourselves. Tickets for all of these events are at mvcranefest.org. The annual Congreso de Acequias is March 7th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Centennial School in San Luis. The Congreso is held to celebrate land, water, and community. It, too, is free and open to the public. The Rio Grande State of the Basin Symposium is Saturday, March 28th at the Adams State University campus. The symposium's keynote speaker is Colorado-based journalist Ben Coldfarb, whose work has appeared in major national publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, Smithsonian Magazine, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, Orion Magazine, and National Geographic. His books include Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter, published in 2018, and Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping Our Planet, published in 2023. It is free to register to attend. You can find a link to register in the SLV Outdoor Report on alamosacitizen.com. And applications are now open for the 2026 Colorado Trout Unlimited River Conservation and Fly Fishing Camp for youth conservation and fly fishing. The fishing camp is a week-long outdoor learning experience for youth ages 14 to 18. The camp will be held June 14th through 20th in Almont, Colorado, and focuses on fly fishing skills, river ecology, conservation, and leadership. The San Luis Valley Trout Unlimited chapter is proud to sponsor two local students to attend this camp on a scholarship. Interested students and families are encouraged to apply. The deadline for applications is March 1st, 2026. For more information or to inquire about scholarship opportunities and information on registration, please contact Kevin Milder at slvtroutunlimited@gmail.com. Camp details and applications are also available at coloradotu.org/youthcamp. That brings us to the end of this episode of the Outdoor Citizen podcast. The Outdoor Citizen is produced and edited by Owen Woods, published by alamosacitizen.com. You can listen to the show wherever you stream your podcasts. If you have an outdoor adventure you'd like to share or if there are topics you'd like to hear about in a future episode, please send an email to info@alamosacitizen.com. As always, we want to thank Don Richmond for his song Sea Turtle and Daniel Boyce for the sounds of the valley's birds. Until next time, this is Marty Jones saying get outside, enjoy this unseasonably warm weather, take a look at the birds that you see in the valley, take a look at the cows, they're starting to calve, get outside and enjoy. Thanks for listening and thanks for tuning in.